You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you for doing so. And this is Spectrum West, the radio voice of the arts and culture of Western Wisconsin. On today's program, we're going to provide a look back at some of the memorable conversations we've had with notable guests. Jim Oliver will be joining me a bit later. And before that, a couple things we'd like you to know about. The East Side Hill neighborhood in Eau Claire takes being neighbors seriously on one hand and enjoyably on the other. We'll tell you about an event that's coming up. And Joel Friedrich is one of many fine educators making their mark on young people and future movers and shakers in Western Wisconsin. He teaches English at UW-Barron County in Rice Lake. He also initiates and chairs other events that further the cause of compound education. So we begin this week with one such project, Red Cedar, the annual journal of the arts and literature featuring work not only by students, but also faculty, staff, members of surrounding communities, and the state of Wisconsin. Well, there's less than a month left for people to submit materials for consideration and insertion in the Red Cedar first. Let's get some background. Joel, how many years has the Red Cedar Review been published?
Well, it started before I was here as a professor of English. It started in about, I think, 1999. I think one of the original names they thought of was the Dandelion, but they went with the Red Cedar Review because the river is running right behind our windows on the campus there.
Ah.
I changed it when I took it on because I expanded the reach of it. It goes out further now, and there's a Red Cedar Review in Michigan. So I dropped the review, so it's just Red Cedar.
Oh, so I just won't say review anymore. Now, how many pieces are usually accepted, or does that vary with what's received every year?
There's an average. You know, we can have a few more, a few less, but we've got 96 pages we work with. About 12 to 16 of those pages are for visual art, photography. It gives us room for about, around 30 poems and about a dozen stories, I'd say.
Who does the reviewing and what criteria is applied?
Well, this magazine is really great because it gives our students at UWBC a chance to get involved in real-world publishing decisions. We receive about 200, 250 poems every year and about 50 to 70 stories. And like I say, we publish, a tenth of those. And so the students themselves, they're freshmen and sophomore students interested in literature and writing and the arts, do all of the reviewing, all of the voting and the discussing and the arguing until they can winnow it down and sift it to the ones that are the best.
What's the criteria as far as applying? You have to be a resident of Wisconsin, yes?
Originally, we were, from 99 to 2006, I guess I'd call it a traditional small campus literary journal, which meant that we published our own students. But we're a real small campus. And so when I came on, I wanted to change the format. You know, it's perfect bound and offset printed and all that. But I also wanted to really expand who we accepted submissions from. So I didn't want to go nationwide. There's kind of a huge gulf between
yes.
the little magazines that publish only on campuses. And then there's a huge cliff you jump off of into the nationwide market for literary magazines. I wanted to find a niche in between, you know, something that was bigger than just local, but smaller than national. So we go for Wisconsin residents, and particularly we focus on Wisconsin undergraduates as much as we can. But we get a rich mix of undergraduates, professional writers, new writers, moms and pops, and high school kids even. So we accept from just about anybody. Up through January 20th is our deadline, and it does have to be by email. We can only accept submissions by email, which is redcedar@uwc.edu.
Cool, and we'll repeat that as we get nearer the end of our conversation. So as you alluded, the current issue right now contains work by students, faculty, staff, and community members. The official language reads, mixed submissions of both poetry and prose are acceptable. Poetry, fiction, creative nonfiction, and other creative writing. Going back to that current issue, I noted photos and drawings were listed. Is that something that you add, or is that just part of the design work?
We do add those. We don't currently have open submissions for photography and visual art.
Okay.
We have a student group that's our campus art club, and one of those art club members is the art editor for Red Cedar every year. And it's kind of up to that group whether they want to go with open submissions or not. We found that kind of difficult to generate a lot of interest in the past, and so we have been doing special projects with our studio art students on campus where they actually have been soliciting poems or stories from pretty famous writers, you know, usually from the Midwest area, and then kind of using their written work as inspiration for visual art, and then we do a special feature in the center.
Do you hear from people who submit things? Do you find that they end up writing something especially for making an entry for the Red Cedar? Or do you find that most people just go back to their files and archives and say, this was nice, I think I'll put that in?
Well, I know we have, in terms of the statewide community of poets and fiction writers, a pretty solid following, I guess. We hear from the same several dozen published poets and fiction writers every year. And I can't say whether they're writing things especially for Red Cedar, but I think they're looking forward to submitting each year. And I know that as soon as I sent out the submission call, I started getting emails from them right away.
The voice of Joel Friedrich, he's Associate Professor of English at UW-Barron County in Rice Lake. They are excited about receiving submissions for Red Cedar, the University of Wisconsin-Barron County's annual Journal of Arts and Literature. And again, the deadline for submitting is Friday, January 20th. Last year, Joel, you had a release of the new review. I'm sorry, I called it a review again. You had the release of the new publication as part of a Thursdays at the U in late April. Are you planning the same format and timetable this year?
Yeah, we've been doing that for probably about 8 years, having a publication party, and we have been focusing it on Thursdays, either the last Thursday in April or the first Thursday in May, because we have the weekly speaking series and performance series every Thursday on campus at 12:30. That's been going on strong for a number of years, and I was the organizer of that initially, and I folded in as many literary events as we could, and Red Cedar was the rollout was one of those. We bring in as many authors that we're publishing that want to show up. We usually get a dozen readers. It's a really nice mix of people. We've had people travel all the way across the state to come and do this, which amazes us. They're happy to be with us for this kind of rollout event.
The official language of getting something submitted reads, send up to 4 poems or up to 3 short prose pieces of up to 1,500 words each. Mixed submissions of both poetry and prose also acceptable. You ask that they include the following information: a postal address, that's the snail mail address, of course, where they'll be receiving mail in May of 2017 so that they can receive a copy of Red Cedar. And you're also hoping that they send a very brief bio note.
Yeah, we get in 20, 25, even 30 words in the last few pages of the magazine where we describe each author who's being published. You know, we usually edit and revise those a little bit so that they fit. And we always like to have the name of the person first in bold, you know, and usually people don't put that in their bio, so we do a little revising. That's one nice thing the students get to do, too, is to just be editors in that way. Hey, Alan,
yeah.
One more thing. We started an award in the last couple of years, a best undergraduate writing in the state that we can get our hands on. We call them the Editor's Choice Awards. The students decide what is the best piece of writing we received in poetry that year and in fiction or prose from a Wisconsin undergraduate. And so that's really been picking up steam. This year we've gotten a lot more interest. The deadline has actually passed for that, but I think it's definitely worth noting. We always feature those pieces of writing right at the front of the magazine.
Again, general submissions for publication in Red Cedar are open to any resident of Wisconsin. The deadline for general submissions is Friday, January 20th. Submissions can be emailed to, give us the address again, would you please, Joel?
Red Cedar, that's R-E-D-C-E-D-A-R, one word, lowercase, at uwc.edu.
Well, you guys up in Rice Lake and at UW-Barron County always find ways of having fun and making life interesting. Joel Friedrich, thanks for being with us on Spectrum West, and we'll be looking for all of your news releases.
All right. Thank you, Al.
You're listening to Spectrum West, final episode for 2016. Support for WPR comes from the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts, presenting a New Year's Eve extravaganza of food, music, and dancing, as well as the stand-up comedy of Stevie Ray. Details of tickets available at MabelTainter.org. Support also comes from Chilson's Corner Motors of Cadott, offering Chrysler, Dodge, and Jeep vehicles with personalized service to meet customer needs. Chilson Corner Motors of Cadott.com. Let our family take care of your family. Are you wondering what's going on stage in Western Wisconsin? Jim Oliver knows. Here he is.
Thanks, Al. Freak the Mighty will be staged by the Eau Claire Children's Theater January the 6th through the 8th at the Oxford Theater in Eau Claire. Guys on Ice will be presented January the 12th through the 15th at the Heidi Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild will present Doubt January the 12th through the 15th and the 19th through the 22nd at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. A Nice Family Christmas will play Fridays and Saturdays through January 7th at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson. The Eau Claire Children's Theater has scheduled auditions for Winnie the Pooh and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe at 5:30 p.m. January the 9th and the 10th at the Oxford Theater. Auditions for Stepping Out, a comedy with tap dancing, will be held at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson on Sunday, January the 8th from 1 to 4 p.m. and Monday, January the 9th from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. For Spectrum West, I'm Jim Oliver.
Well, you know, much has been written about the impersonal ways many neighborhoods now exist, with decks built on the backs of houses today as opposed to porches on the front. Porches whereon people used to wave and talk to passers-by, or the act of remotely closing one's garage door after arriving home while still in the vehicle, thereby eliminating contact with the world outside said garage. Well, it doesn't appear as if residents of the Eastside Hill in Eau Claire embrace the touchless contemporary system. They still stride the sidewalks, waving at and talking with each other, and their association is much more than figurative, it's functional. Tracy Ullman lives in the Eastside Hill neighborhood and decided to make one of their many amenities an appreciation of diversity. She stopped in the other day for a conversation. We're talking about an event, and it's sponsored by the association's diversity committee. And for something to even have a diversity committee, it must be a pretty engaging organization. Tell us about the East Hill Neighborhood Association, what you know of it.
Well, the Eastside Hill Neighborhood Association has been around for quite a while, I believe. I just recently started getting involved. We have a steering committee, which I am now a part of since I started this group as well. And actually in September is when I started this, what we're now calling Humankind, but is our diversity committee.
We'll talk about this particular event in a minute, but what other things does the association do? Is it like living in Disneyland, living in the East Hill neighborhood?
Absolutely, just like Disneyland. Well, some of the things that I've been aware of, I know they have a neighborhood picnic every year that I went to this fall.
All right.
One of the projects that we've been working on is getting the speed limit on Margaret to be 25 instead of 30, because it's a walking community people go more than 30 on Margaret.
It's usually 5 miles an hour over at least.
Yes.
People do.
Yes. And that's kind of a tough one. And so we've had some people who on our steering committee who have been working with the city council to try to get that changed. And we just hosted a caroling party last Thursday night. That was just a little community get-together. I think they've done Coob. And like I said, I haven't been involved in the Eastside Hill Neighborhood Association for very long. So, frankly, I'm not real sure of all the other things they've done.
Well, I went to the website. It's kind of an impressive website as well. The history, there were Northeast and West villages back then in Eau Claire. And that's pretty impressive. What other than sunsets over the downtown area do residents of the East Hill share? I'm guessing there's a ton of pride in keeping the neighborhood as it was, as it is.
Yeah, I think it's a very historical place, and there's a very nice neighborly feel in the Eastside Hill. People talk to each other. There's I have a dog. I see a lot of people when I'm out walking my dog. People are very friendly to one another. There's a lot of historical old bungalows there that are really beautiful, and a lot of charm to the architecture there. And it's the kind of place you just feel like you're safe and people care about each other and you talk to each other, and it's a good place.
Are you aware of any covenants in living in the neighborhood where you have to keep things in a certain way, that you can't paint your house pink or you can't...
Not as far as I'm aware. I know years ago I was painting my foundation, which is kind of an Eau Claire thing to paint your foundation.
Yeah, well, cool.
And I had bought primer and it was bright pink, and I put a sign in my yard that said, "It's primer," so that people would know that I was really painting it kind of a pretty brick color, but...
For people who don't know, the boundaries of the East Hill neighborhood are the Eau Claire River on the north, Brackett Avenue on the south, Hastings Way on the east, and Harding Avenue and the bottom of the East Hill Bluff on the west side as it skirts the east side of downtown. Mm-hmm. The neighborhood has a large cemetery. You have parks. You have schools. It's close to downtown, which is enjoying quite a renaissance, as we all know. It's a best of a lot of worlds, isn't it?
Yes, there? It really is. And all of those things that you said, and the location is wonderful. It is a walking area, lots of people out on their bikes. And I live right on the cemetery, so it's like having a park in your backyard and really quiet neighbors. So that's nice.
I would think so. I wonder if somewhere along the line in history there was some sort of a toboggan slide or ski jump that went down that bluff.
Oh, well, there's a sliding hill there now. I think it's nicknamed Seven Bumps. Well, and we also have a skating rink in Boyd Park.
Well, there you go.
And Boyd Park is a really, really wonderful resource for us. In fact, we've been using the warming house there as our meeting place. Oh. And there's a nice pavilion. The park itself is beautiful, and of course, it's right along the river there. It's a beautiful location. You kind of are in the heart of the city, but there's a lot of nature right around.
And it's pretty safe to walk to Boyd Park because there's a tunnel now, isn't there?
Yes. Yeah. There's a wonderful tunnel that they put in when the school was still there.
How cool is that?
Yeah. And I think if the skating rink isn't open yet, it will be soon.
Are you aware of any other neighborhood associations in Eau Claire?
There are several active neighborhood associations in town.
Is there competition between them?
Not as far as I'm aware.
There should be. Neighborhood Association Olympics or something.
Yeah, there you go. That would be fun. We do have a pretty active COOB group.
Is there a certain ethnicity that's prevalent?
Not that I'm
Because you bring
aware
a COOB
of.
And maybe it had to do with Scandinavians.
Well, I think some people who live in our neighborhood went to either Norway, somewhere in Scandinavia, and came back with it.
East Hill Neighborhood Association and the City of Eau Claire share a comprehensive plan. And one of the missions reads like this: the city should maintain or revive the traditional urban character of the older neighborhoods so that they remain attractive places to live.
Yes.
That's pretty cool.
That's a very good mission.
Sitting in the studio and enjoying a conversation with Tracy Ullman. She is representing the East Hill Neighborhood Association that is in Eau Claire. And they have an event coming up Saturday, the 7th of January. It's called Food, Folk, and Fun. It's from 5:30 to 8 p.m. It's at Spirit Lutheran Church, which is on Main Street. You're focusing on diversity. Has the association in meetings tabbed that as an important issue in your neighborhood?
I was really just feeling all summer long, like with all the unrest in the world and a lot of violence, and just thinking, what can I do? What can I do? So I thought the best place to probably start is my neighborhood. So I know Shannon Paulus, and Mike Paulus is one of the editors of Volume 1. I talked to her one day, and she said, well, I just happen to be on the steering committee of the Eastside Hill Neighborhood Association, and if you want to bring your proposal, that would be great. So I wanted to start this diversity group, and it's sort of a subcommittee of our association, and we're calling it Humankind. We finally have a name.
With an accent on the kind.
Right, with an accent on the kind.
The K-I-N-D, all capitalized.
Yeah,
that's pretty
right.
Cool.
Yeah, and our mission is to build community and to celebrate diversity, and I just noticed there were more and more people in our neighborhood who are of different ethnicities, I would assume of different religions, all sorts of different kinds of people. And I just wanted to make sure that as a person who's fairly mainstream America, if I can use that word, that people feel welcome and safe and included and appreciated. So we started this little subcommittee, and we've been meeting monthly, and we've got this event coming up, which we're hoping to build some community with that. And the potluck part of it, we're hoping people will bring food from their family culture and share a little bit of their culture with us. And we're going to have Mark Helpsmeet there, who is a member of the International Eau Claire International Folk Dance Society.
Well, there you go.
And he's going to lead international folk dancing, which will be kind of a nice cultural event as
mm-hmm,
well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that'll be a really fun community-building event. And we're trying to do a few other things like education and kind of awareness. And building community is really important.
All of us as individuals are different.
Right, absolutely.
We're all diverse.
Yes.
So you could celebrate diversity no matter what.
That's right.
So you have food, you have dance. Who's providing the music?
I believe Mark is bringing the music with him.
He's going to tutor you on different kinds of dances.
Yes, and like I said, there is a group that meets in Eau Claire regularly, an international folk dance group. And they're very much community-type dances, circle dances, things where everyone's dancing together more than an emphasis on, like, partner dancing or something like that. Okay. Really very much a kind of building community kind of dance structure as well.
As a music teacher, you're probably relishing this, aren't you?
I definitely am. This is sort of in my bliss zone.
So this was your brainchild?
This was, yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm excited. You know, it just feels like it's something positive to be doing with my energy right now. And
sometimes
it feels a little negative. It feels good to be doing something
You're
positive.
Doing your part. You're doing more than your part. Way to go.
Thank you.
The website is eastsidehill.com. Food, folk, and fun, January 7th, 5:30 to 8 p.m., Spirit Lutheran Church, Main Street, Eau Claire, sponsored by the Eastside Hill Neighborhood Association's Diversity Committee. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
The foundation of understanding is small gestures put forth by individuals. You're listening to Spectrum West. We appreciate you doing so. You know, 2016 was a good year. It was interesting for many reasons. It may turn out pivotal politically and in aspects of life touched by legislation. The arts and culture in Western Wisconsin is a proud constant because people require the arts to be a part of the culture. On Spectrum West, we have the privilege of talking with those who provide and support so many opportunities to read and listen and participate and appreciate all of it. Jim Oliver's here, and we're going to look back at and listen to bits of just a few of the conversations we've had and mention others. I wish I could comment on all 50 shows produced in 2016. That means several hundred guests, and every one of them with important and entertaining information. Jim Oliver, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here again.
Yes. It's seldom that we get together live in a studio.
Exactly. We go several weeks sometimes without seeing each other, which is probably a healthy situation.
Yes. I think that's why we're such good friends.
Yeah.
Well, Jim's here, and he's going to be providing a few of the conversations that were notable for him in 2016. Let's begin with something that I remember back in February. Peter Noone, a.k.a. Herman of Herman's Hermits, one of the British invasion bands of the 1960s, appeared at the State Theater. I recall one of the things he talked about was the unspoken etiquette and courtesy that one could find back then, even among what were actually competing bands. Let's listen in.
Tommy James was explaining the fifth to me in his book. He goes, you know, I did this gig and Peter Noone was so kind to us and the other people on the show weren't kind to us. And he came down to the dressing room and said, welcome on our tour and everything. And it was so special. It really, when I read the story, I tried to think, why did I do that? Why did I think that it was appropriate to go down to somebody's dressing room as the headliner of the show and say, thank you for being on the tour to these kids, right? And I said, oh, I know where I got it from. The Beatles did it to us. The Beatles came down to our dressing room and said, hey, lads, thank you for being on the tour. And it kind of was like something to carry on, right?
Oh,
and keep
well,
on the traditional part side of it. So I thought, but I wonder why the Beatles did that. Who did they get it from? So I go to, you know, I know Tony Bramwell, who's always worked, he's been working for the Beatles since he was 13 or something, you know, and he's always there for that. So where did the Beatles get it from? Roy Orbison. Roy Orbison was on a tour in England, and the Beatles were on the tour, and he went down to their dressing room and said, oh, lads, thank you for being on the tour. So you see, there's a musical tradition of people being kind to one another because they're musicians. I don't think for 1 minute Roy Orbison said, uh-oh, there's the competition down there. Nowadays, people do. That's what changed the music business. They suddenly turned it into a competition. You know, like, I was in competition with the Beatles. Who'd be stupid enough to join a competition where the Beatles were in it? We all knew that it was non-competitive, but if you were unique and different, you would have a position. Win or lose, you would still have a position. So, you know, that's what's different now. I remember we once in a huge fight, we got in this big fight on a motorway in England, the first motorway, and there was a transport cafe. And for some reason, men who drove trucks did not like musicians with long hair and pointy shoes. And there was this massive fight, like, they were picking on one band, I can't remember the name of the band, but Jack Bruce, who recently passed away, says he remembers me getting involved in the fight. And Tom Jones, in his book, remembers me getting in fight. But there were never fights for me. It was always a fight where somebody was picking on somebody else, and my Roman Catholic Jesuit upbringing said, you've got to get involved in this fight.
So a little bit of the conversation we had with Peter Noon, or Herman from Herman's Hermits. It's a lot of fun. Put on a good show, too, in Eau Claire. And you know, in March, one of America's favorite folk singer-songwriters, Charlie McGuire, helped launch The Big Read. It was a month of events centered on the classic The Grapes of Wrath, sponsored by the ArtReach St. Croix and Friends. Of course, any talk of Tom Joad from the book brings to mind a guy named Woody Guthrie, who wrote a song about him. Charlie McGuire was a big Woody Guthrie fan and friend to folk legends like Pete Seeger and Lee Hayes. Charlie is someone you just can't pass up.
I remember exactly where I was the day I found out that Woody passed away in October of 1967. I was crossing the campus at Northland College, and I got a letter from my mother that Woody had passed away. And then later, I got to know a little bit of the family. Woody's second wife, Marjorie, at that time was trying to organize his papers 5-6 years after his death. I encouraged her to do whatever she could to publish these things, because people were just so hungry to find out the truth about this great man. And there was so much myth that he was a vagabond. And yes, he was. But he was also one of the most learned vagabonds you'd ever meet. Lee used to tell me how he would camp at Lee's apartment in Greenwich Village and not leave until he had read every book in his library that he hadn't read already. And like Steinbeck, Woody was born to write. I mean, he lived to write. Write on anything. I remember those stories that Arlo used to tell about his dad, how he would write on paper bags, the backs of newspapers, wrapping paper, butcher paper, anything he could get his hands on.
There again, you have some empathy for his wife having to go through all of his stuff after he passed away.
Most other people, Alan, would have thrown it out. There was so much of it, so much, in fact, that it's filled an entire building now in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where the archives are now.
You pointed out to me in an email that Woody Guthrie is honored on a postage stamp. It's probably good that Woody never found out he was on a postage stamp, because Lord knows he probably would have written a song about it.
I've come back, my river.
So there's a little bit of Charlie McGuire, who, by the way, appeared on Spectrum West on the 24th of March. Some of the people who came early in 2016, I'm talking about notable people, people that everyone in America has heard of. Eric Hipple, former NFL quarterback, appeared at the UW Eau Claire Forum. Vicki Emerson, singer in February. Also, as we mentioned, Peter Noon. Cheryl Bailey, jazz guitarist, was on the show on the 18th of February, as was Anders Hall, a Swedish fiddler who came up to Luck and Barron. Mark Peterson does a wonderful job of bringing in the Scandinavian musicians up there. Kenny Holman, sax player, came to the Mabel Tainter. He was on the 3rd of March. Ellis Paul, a singer-songwriter, was at the Heidi. Dr. Amir Ahmed, intercultural educator, was also on the show in March. Jim Oliver, you talked to a lot of interesting people this past year. You always get to talk to the writers, the authors, and the directors and the actors. One author that you talked to had an especially interesting and unique book.
I should say, I grew up on a farm in the old days, small farm. We raised a few cows, a few pigs, and a few chickens.
You
called cow, sow, hen was the phrase.
Cool.
Anyway, so I was drawn to a book entitled Locally Laid, How We Built a Plucky, Industry-Changing Egg Farm from Scratch. It's one of the books featured in the Chippewa Valley Book Festival last October. And it's a story about how a couple of city kids went from raising a few chickens in their backyard to developing a full-fledged chicken farm. I asked Lucy Amundson, who's the author of the book and one half of the chicken farm management team, if she or her husband had a farm background and also if they produced organic eggs.
No, I definitely was and kind of still am a reluctant farmer. It's not my training or background or really my husband's either. But Jason, my spouse, just kind of became smitten with our backyard birds and really wanted to do more and thought the eggs were so great. Everyone should have access to eggs raised in this manner. He laid out this plan for me. I had no idea this was coming. I would like to tell you I was supportive. But what happened next was the farm argument.
Well, so neither of you had a farming background other than the backyard chickens?
Our ancestral families did, but we ourselves have been cubicle-bound keyboard jockeys. We're of the service sector. We write things and organize things, and suddenly we were doing things. So we use non-GMO feed grown by people in our region. What that does is that it creates, the ag economists would call it, value chains, so that we are hiring neighbors to grow corn. We use our local feed bin to grind it, mix it, store it. And we've built our own egg washing facilities, so that way we are getting in on the washing and packing. And we do some, not all, of our own distribution. And what that does is creates this economic vitality that swirls around a region. Honestly, we feel like that is probably more to our values than importing corn from 6,000 miles away.
See, that's interesting stuff. Interesting and entertaining at the same time. That had to be a fun interview.
It was fun because she just has a really good sense of humor. The whole book is about how much agony they went through. From the beginning where they had trouble finding a supplier for supplier for chickens.
Yeah. They got the wrong kind.
They got the wrong guy the first time, right? She said, we found a guy. And I said, yeah, the guy.
That's right.
three-letter word that stands for trouble.
Yeah, that was
they
fun.
Had plenty of it.
Well, the Eau Claire Jazz Festival is always a source of wonderful personalities with whom to talk. The 2016 festival brought one of the true pioneering jazz icons to western Wisconsin, Jimmy Heath. He plays the saxophone. The Heath brothers played the joint in Eau Claire back in the day, and prior to his arrival for the festival, Jimmy was gracious enough to take time for Spectrum West and try to satisfy my need to understand the feeling of getting in to a musical groove. Now, I read that someone in the group, the Heath brothers, talked about the fact that you guys got into, and here's the quote, grooves that were so deep. Explain to our audience what a deep groove is and what it feels like.
When it makes us feel like we are doing something very special and unique because we are the same genes and we are from the same parents, and there's a feeling that togetherness that is very important that you get sometimes, you know, you can get it with other people too. I mean, it's a connection. But the connection with the Heath brothers is built right in because it's a family connection. Or the Adderley brothers, or the Montgomery brothers, or the Hamptons. You know, there were a lot of brothers groups. Becker brothers from Philly, you know. There's a lot of brothers who played very well together. So we're not unique in that way.
But it's a musical groove. It's a moment. It's a time when you're.
It's a feeling, and sometimes we feel much better about the way we sounding than other times. Mm-hmm. We're human. We missed the groove tonight. We didn't get on that particular song, but they were nice when the brothers. We felt that, oh, man. And my brother Percy, we saw, we said, oh, don't go in there. We can't stay in there. And he would be playing the bass. I say, well, I'm glad we did go in there.
Yeah.
I know we can't stay perfect. Like it seems like we all, at that moment, we almost have a perfect feeling and a relationship.
Like going to a carnival.
I guess so.
If you don't want to leave, you're having such a good...
Yeah, you don't want to leave. You're having such a good time at the moment.
There you go.
You don't want that moment to change.
Mm-hmm.
But it always does, you know. You can't stay in that moment because another moment's coming.
Who can ever forget Jimmy Heath? Wow, what a good guy. April 21st of 2016 was a sad day. The WPR family lost a grandfather, Carl Schmidt, long-time air personality and favorite of many. The same day, Prince, the extraordinary musician and songwriter, also left the earth for somewhere out there. We repeated an earlier appearance of Carl Schmidt on Spectrum West, and this was all happening on the Thursday following their passing. We talked with Liz Reiko-Lutz, who was a fashion designer and seamstress for Prince, for a few years. So that was kind of a milestone for the year as well. Speaking of music, we talked about the polka, Jim Oliver and I. Was it alive and well? We'll talk about that coming up. This is Spectrum West. Jim Oliver and I are looking back at 2016. Some of the people with whom we spoke. Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Mayo Clinic Health System, now offering flu vaccines and encouraging rest, good nutrition, and washing hands to promote good health overall. More information at mayoclinichealthsystem.org. So that's correct, Jim. You and I sat down one day and we said, you know, what about the polka? And we talked about old, what's the word I'm looking for, ballrooms.
Oh, the old, yeah.
That right. Might still be around in Minnesota and western Wisconsin.
They are a diminishing breed, however.
They are, yes. But the polka still lives. What did you find out?
Well, the Jim Busta Band, a polka band from Onalaska, was among the featured music makers at the Chippewa Falls Oktoberfest last September.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Busta talked about his beginnings in the music business. Appearing with him up at Chippewa mm-hmm. was his daughter, Molly Busta Lang, who is better known by many as Molly B., producer and host of the Molly B. Polka Party program on the cable channel RFD-TV. Molly B., who has a master's degree in music instruction from St. Mary's University in Winona, I should also include that Jim Busta was once a high school principal.
Huh?
So these are pretty well-educated folk playing a polka, which I used to be laughed at because I was so gross as to enjoy polka music. But anyway, Molly talked about the impact of polka music and why she is still drawn to it over the years. And Jim Busta talked about his beginnings, as I said.
Grew up on a farm in northeast Iowa, and my father had a little button accordion around home, so I used to play that a little bit. We used to go to different dances in the area, and sometimes bands coming from Wisconsin and Minnesota, they would have concertinas with them, and I really fell in love with the concertina. I actually purchased my first concertina when I came out of the military, which is in the early 70s, and then there was nobody around to give me lessons. The closest one would have been up to New Ulm, Minnesota. So I just took a self-instruction book and kind of taught myself from there.
You got your family involved in the band pretty early.
Yes, we have four children, and I tried to instill a little bit of piano with all of them, but it was primarily Molly who continued with the piano. But my son, Chad, who's our drummer, did his first drumming job when he was like 6 or 7 and then was a regular after that age. It still is our drummer today and runs the sound for our band. And then Molly, I think, started when she was about 8 or 9 years old, probably did some singing before that, and was a regular from age 11 on, primarily playing keyboard and trumpet at the time, and then adding other instruments after that.
Well, Molly, you have a degree in music from Luther College, according to your biography. You have a master's in instruction from St. Mary's University in Winona, Minnesota. And yes. I know you do perform non-polka music, so what holds your interest in polka music?
Part of it is the history. Part of it is the fun, the people, the way I personally feel when I hear polka music. Very uplifting to me. You can't frown. You can't be mad when you're hearing polka music. It's neat to see children's reaction, particularly toddlers' reaction to polka music. They just cling to it. They start bouncing up and down. Then you have people that will listen to music from the age 5 to 55. But then you have, you know, everyone 55 and older. There's so many of them that listen to it. And it's what keeps them going sometimes, that music and the history that goes with that music, the memories they've had. And I've met so many people, particularly after the Molly B. Polka Party started. This music means so much to them. And to know that I can help bring this music alive again in their life and help them see the joy in it, help them bring back old memories, it's priceless. I don't ever see myself not playing this genre of music because of all those reasons.
I think we have to do more polka stuff, Jim.
I certainly agree with that. You know, interestingly enough about Molly B., she plays an incredible number of instruments.
Yeah.
I asked her about what she plays, and she said she plays trumpet, trombone, clarinet, and piano proficiently.
Uh-huh.
But she also plays the button accordion, the drums, and can play strings.
Okay.
But she said her strongest is her voice. She's
cool.
Taken more voice instruction than anything else.
By the way, you did this interview probably in October, and that was shortly after you came back from 3 weeks off. You had some fairly serious surgery in September, so...
Actually, this was done in the end of August, before I went in, before I had my surgery. Oh, that's why my voice sounds pretty good yet.
You wanted to get it in just in case.
Yeah. Yes, right. I thought, well, this is Jim Oliver's last interview.
Well, we missed
and
you.
And boy, are we glad he's gone.
We missed you. We missed you a lot.
Yeah, well...
You know, September featured the likes of Garrison Keillor as a guest. I was privileged to spend some phone time with the humorist, author, producer, and former host of A Prairie Home Companion. This clip is one in which he talks about laughter.
You know, I believe in laughter. I took my daughter, who's 18, to the Minnesota State Fair, and the ride that she has loved since she was a child, because it makes her laugh. Helpless, convulsive laughter is a ride called the River Run, which she and I call the pee ride, and because you sit in a raft and you go down this sluiceway, artificial, over rapids and falls, and water comes splashing onto your raft, and when you get done with the ride, I stand up and I walk away, and it looks like I could not wait, you know, to go to the men's room. And she looks at me, and she falls apart. She's done this every year since she was a little kid. Convulsive laughter is very rare. So, I mean, if you can possibly bring the audience to it or toward it, you know, you're really doing a service. I have a few stories that I can tell that do make people laugh very hard, and I kind of, you know, maintain them and trot them out, and so I would expect to do them at the State Theater in Eau Claire if there's any way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Eau Claire is a guffawing community, just so you know. Did that ride do the same thing to you? Did you laugh?
I don't laugh.
You don't?
Okay. It's not my role. I hardly ever laugh, and... But she did, and so, you know, it accomplished that.
Little Butch Thompson in the background, one of the former piano players on A Prairie Home Companion. Pat Donahue, one of Keillor's regular musicians for many years on A Prairie Home Companion, also visited Spectrum West in 2016. Another one of my favorite guests this past year, simply because he's such a wonderful mixture of musical talent and unlimited energy, was Phil Cook, an Eau Claire native now living in North Carolina, who brought his Southland Review to the second Eau Claire Festival. He puts a certain kind of relish on top of everything he serves. Let's listen to a bit of that conversation. You seem to be a guy that has collected things as you have gone through life, and you sort of bring them along with you in a little bag or a box. As you go, you say, well, yeah, I should do something with this. I mean, your work with the Blind Boys of Alabama, the Charlie Parr Project, immersing yourself in the Virginia cabin, all those things have turned out to be parts of your scrapbook.
I think you called it. I'm really lucky. I think the way I learned how to play music and the way I learned how to play in a band started back in high school, and the people that I found, that we all found each other in Eau Claire. And it was a really incredible happenstance that happened to me. It really formed the way I look at music and still do, because I do think it's a lot more about friendship and relationships and the experience than it is about anything else.
Phil is performing Saturday in a thing called Southland Review, which I read, by the way, you've taken on the road already. You had it in Newport. How'd that go?
So good. It's unbelievable. Yeah, it was just a... Honestly, you know, it was really emotional. Those men are my heroes, and I'm privileged and honored to call them my friends at this point, too. That's really rare. It's really rare for anyone to have your hero be your friend. Usually they're very separate things. So the Blind Boys are great because not only do I get to observe their greatness on stage, but I get to observe it side by side, shoulder to shoulder with them on the stage.
Yeah.
But I also get to just enjoy calling them on the phone and talking to them and just talking about our families and talking about gospel music, talking about things that we love. How can you put a value on that? That's insane. They gave a performance, and I've played with them several dozen times now at this point, that topped anything I've been with them before. And it just moved me to the core of my being.
Such a good time. Such a good guy. Phil Cook. Hey, there's a polka.
Wow. I wonder why polkas are so popular around here.
They just don't go away.
No, I mean,
but who doesn't like to polka? So like Molly said, it's how can you feel bad when you're listening
it's
to polka?
Fun.
So you delved into polkas even deeper.
Oh, gosh, yes. Earlier last year, an author, Rick March, and photographer Dick Blau published Polka Heartland, Why the Midwest Loves to Polka. And Rick March appeared on Spectrum West, and I asked him to settle the old argument about where did the polka originate.
In my book, I tried to clarify the origin story. There's a lot of myth going around about it, and you can find it all over the internet nowadays, that a servant girl who's either Czech or Polish at some time in the 1830s was seen dancing it by her boss, who's usually a learned guy like a teacher or a doctor or something, and he writes down the dance, and then it spread all over the place. Well, essentially, nobody knows exactly when it started, even though, because in legends, people like details, you know, she's been given a name, Anna Slezkova, in some versions, you know, exactly what village it was, whether it was at 2 p.m. on the afternoon of such and such a day. You know, people love that detail, but there's no reliable evidence of that. So, you know, the important thing to understand is the polka was an early pop culture dance fad. It emerged in the 19th century at a time when society was changing. More people were moving to the cities, working in factories and stuff. They weren't just down on the farm, and they wanted a music and dance that reflected that new way of life. The polka came along as an outrageous dance, just the earlier dance fad of the waltz, which was also criticized as being, you know, too risque, you know, had lost its punch after, you know, three or so decades. And now along comes the polka, where they're doing a more frenetic 2-4 time dance, hopping up and down. It was considered so outrageous that Queen Victoria forbade the polka ever to be danced in her presence during the 1850s.
My goodness. Yeah, I think some of that may have carried over into early in the last century as well. My parents met in the 1930s at a barn dance.
Uh-huh.
And my father was a Methodist, and my mother was a kind of a Lutheran. And the Methodists were very much opposed to dancing in those days.
Yeah.
And so we kind of hid the fact from our Methodist relatives that we, you know, we actually did go to dances. When I say we, I say that accurately because they used to take me along. So
sure.
That's how my, you know, my experience with dancing, going to dances, was early 1940s when I was, before I even started school.
Yeah, that's right. It was very much an intergenerational thing. And then when the kids got tired, they might spread some coats out on the floor or over a couple of chairs and put them to sleep.
Oh, sure.
At the dances. You know, a lot of people have told me those stories, especially in the family bands. A lot of bands are multi-generation family bands, and mm-hmm. I've heard musicians say, yeah, I started going with my parents to these dances, and they'd lay me down at the back of the stage and have me go to sleep.
So you talked about yourself as a kid, but I think you're not mentioning the fact that you can cut a pretty mean rug even today. Isn't
not it? So much. Gotten old, and arthritis has set in, and so I could do a waltz, I guess. I used to do the 2/4 time polka in what used to be called Polish style, which was a great cardiovascular exercise
yes.
because it would kill you off if you weren't careful.
Those were fun chats.
Yeah. Could I go back just quickly?
Yes.
You met at the end of the Garrison Keillor. You broke some news in the Garrison Keillor thing because he actually laughed.
Yes, he did.
And he said he didn't ever laugh. Then you also mentioned Butch Thompson. Butch Thompson was on Spectrum West several years ago, before your time, I believe. He was one of the performers at the Ragtime Festival.
He was.
Yep. And so he's wonderful. Not really nice guy. Really nice guy.
Yeah, I mean, Spectrum West is more of a is kind of a reality show too. If you think about it, because you know, like I said, I exposed something about Garrison Keillor that he might not have wanted exposed.
Well,
don't care about that.
No, that's, he probably doesn't care either when he gets right down to it.
Well, Spectrum West in 2016 had a lot of fun. We talked to, as I said, hundreds of people, folks representing Ladysmith, Chippewa Falls, Rice Lake, Hudson, Eau Claire, St. Croix Falls, Winona, Luck Barron, Menominee, New Richmond, River Falls, Amory, Stockholm, Alma, Duran, Sorona, Arcadia, La Crosse, Pepin, Spooner, Clear Lake, and Clayton, Osceola, and more. Spectrum West is here. If it's part of the culture of Western Wisconsin, we find a way to feature it. 2017 will be bigger and better because that's how Western Wisconsin does things. And Spectrum West will be along for the ride. Thank you, Jim Oliver. And we look forward to more of great stuff in 2017.
Oh, it's great fun. Great to talk to people. That's the great fun of it all.
No kidding. And thank you guys for being our audience and our topics combined. Keep up the great work. We'll see you next week.